River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org. This is Rosie Starr for Radio Catskill. Welcome to Farm and Country, locally produced radio about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. On today's show, Keith Hubbard has a Star Talk report that says the waning crescent moon points the way to viewing Saturn and Jupiter in dawn's eastern sky. Outdoor enthusiast Alex and Matthew Hoshka from Cook's Falls have an early spring fishing report relating to conditions in the Catskill region. Mark Gidley, arborist living in Hankins, New York, visits with Stephanie Phillips. In the segment Now You Know, you'll hear practical information about choosing a tree for your property. All of that coming up on today's Farm and Country here on Radio Catskill. But first, news headlines from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Barbara Klein. Flags at the White House are flying at half-staff to honor the Capitol police officer who was killed yesterday after a man rammed his car into a barricade at the U.S. Capitol building. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports the attack is heightening what's already a demanding time for Capitol police.
Acting Capitol Police Chief Yogananda Pittman noted it's been a challenging period for her agency since the January 6th insurrection.
I just ask that the public continue to keep U.S. Capitol Police and their families in your prayers. This has been an extremely difficult time for U.S. Capitol Police.
The suspect struck two U.S. Capitol Police officers at the North Security Checkpoint for the Capitol. Police said William Evans, an 18-year veteran of the force who went by the name Billy, died in the attack. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, Washington.
The murder trial of Derek Chauvin has gone into recess for the weekend after the Minneapolis Police Department's most senior officer testified yesterday. Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio reports Lieutenant Richard Zimmerman told jurors George Floyd posed no threat to police after he was handcuffed.
Zimmerman has been with the department since 1985 and leads its homicide division. Here's how he responded when a prosecutor asked if Chauvin was right to press his knee into George Floyd's neck, even as Floyd lay handcuffed face down.
Putting your knee on a neck for that amount of time is just uncalled for. I saw no reason why the officers felt they were in danger.
The defense argues that Chauvin, who's charged with murder and manslaughter, was acting within his training. But Zimmerman said he himself was never trained in such a technique. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in Minneapolis.
The Suez Canal Authority says the backup of ships caused by last week's grounding of the giant container ship Ever Given is over. Officials say all 422 ships stuck for days have now passed through the canal. In Myanmar, military leaders continue their violent crackdown on opponents of the February 1st coup. Michael Sullivan reports at least two people were killed today.
Most of today's deaths occurred when security forces opened fire with live ammunition on protesters in several towns in the center of the country. State-run television says arrest warrants have been issued for more than a dozen critics of the regime, including journalists and actors. The Assistance Association for Political Prisoners, a local rights group, says at least 550 civilians have been killed since February 1st, including nearly 50 children.
This is NPR News.
Support comes from Van Gorder's Furniture, featuring Lodge and Adirondack styles as well as rustic collections. With showrooms at Lake Wallenpaupack, downtown Honesdale, and Milford, PA, Van Gorder's Furniture brings the outdoors inside. VanGorders.com.
This is Rosie Starr. Welcome back to Farm and Country. Coming up, we have Alex and Matthew Hoshka from Cook's Falls with an early spring fishing report for the Catskill region. Mark Gidley, arborist from Hankins, New York, speaks with Stephanie Phillips. In the segment Now You Know, you'll hear about choosing a tree for your property. First up is Keith Hubbard with a Star Talk report about viewing Saturn and Jupiter. Thank you for joining us for this week's locally produced Farm and Country.
Farm and Country. I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. The Moon will be your guide to the two largest planets in our solar system this week. The waning crescent moon will sweep past Jupiter, the largest planet, and Saturn, the second largest planet, over the course of the week. The trio of celestial bodies will be in the southeastern sky before dawn. On Monday, all three will be high enough in the sky to be seen by 5 a.m. The crescent moon will be the highest and most southerly of the three, and its lighted side will point towards Saturn and Jupiter. The moon will be 14 degrees to the right of Saturn. Saturn will be fainter and higher in the sky than Jupiter, and Jupiter will be closest to the horizon. All three bodies will be nearly in a straight line angled down toward the east. Saturn and Jupiter will be visible for a little more than 1 hour before they are lost in the early morning sunlight. The moon will remain visible all morning, setting just before 1 p.m. On Tuesday, the moon will be 4 degrees below Saturn, and on Wednesday, the moon will be 4 degrees below Jupiter. On Thursday, the moon will be 13 degrees to the lower left of Jupiter and will not rise until 5:30 a.m. The moon sweeps past the planets because it is closer to Earth than the planets and thus moves faster across the sky. Use the moon to find Saturn and Jupiter low in the southeastern sky before dawn this week. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard, reminding you to keep looking up.
For Radio Catskill, this is Alex and Matt from Cooks Falls with an outdoor report from our region. Today we'll be providing an early spring fishing report. April 1st was the opening of trout season statewide, so for you fly anglers out there, this is a great time to dust off that gear and hit the river. While it is still early, after a long winter, those trout are going to be looking to feed. It is quite early to get dry fly action, but on a sunny day, you may get some quill gordons on select spots in the river. A more reliable option to catch trout this time of year is to throw large streamers and nymphs in the end of riffles and in slow, deep pools. For streamer patterns, you're going to want to use large flies such as woolly buggers, zonkers, and muddler minnows. Fish these flies right along the bottom and use them on a straight retrieve, every once in a while giving a little twitch. Sometimes that's all it takes to entice a hungry trout to hit. If you are looking to spin fish for trout, spinners such as blue foxes and larger rooster tails worked in the same areas can be very productive. This is a good time of year to use large stick baits such as Rapalas and Husky Jerks as well. These lures imitate bait fish, which is what trout are looking to feed on this time of year. Water conditions can be a little high due to all the spring runoff we've had, so make sure the water you are looking to fish is safe to wade, and if you are wading, wear waders with a wading belt, and if you can, carry a walking staff with you to help you balance in the river. Good fly lines and weights to use for this time of year are a 5-6 weight fly rod with matching line. If you're fishing dry flies, use a floating weight forward line. And if you are fishing with nymphs or streamers, use a sink tip. This will help get those flies close to the bottom, and you won't need to use as much weight on your fly or on your leader. For spin fishermen, use a ultralight to light rod, 5.5-6.5 foot long, with a spinning reel loaded with 4-6 pound test. This time of year, it can be beneficial to put on a leader, so a short section of 10- or 12-pound fluorocarbon will help keep your lure on and prevent you from getting cut off on rocks or the sharp teeth of trout.
For those of you who are fishing warm water, lakes, ponds, runoff areas, make sure that you check your weather conditions before you decide to go out and fish. For those of you that are bass fishing, it is imperative that you make sure your water temperature is above 50 degrees. If your water temperature is not above 50 degrees, make sure you find baits that are still slow. Think back in fall when we went out and fished. Make sure you're using baits that are either moving at a slow pace, like jerk baits, small swim baits, something that the fish aren't going to have to move far to get. If your water is above 50 degrees, you can start using baits that move a little bit faster. Look for signs at the lake that there's bait fish around. Usually small ponds are going to be filled with minnows, bluegill, and other small bait fish. If you can find these bait fish, you will find other fish chasing them. Fish are going to be hungry. You can throw larger baits, swim baits, baits that impersonate bait fish of the lake, and soft baits, swim baits, can be used to effectively catch bass this time of year. The biggest thing is finding where these bass are going to be. Male bass are going to start moving up out of the deep water to find shallow flats to start getting ready for the spawn. They're going to make beds, and before they do that, they're going to stage to move into this shallower water. If you can find these fish, you'll usually find a whole bunch. You'll find schools and multiple fish in the same area. So if you catch one, don't decide to move. Fish that area thoroughly before you move on. If you find fish moving out of these deep pockets and into shallower water, find baits that can get right up along banks and into this shallow water and be fished effectively. This can include Texas rigs, whether it's worms, small swim baits, creature baits, or other soft plastics are a great start. If you find spots where fish are congregating looking for bait fish, crankbaits, small swim baits, and jerkbaits are very effective. If you're looking for bigger bass, these are going to be the females that are still staging the deeper water. This can be a little bit more of a challenge, but large swim baits, baits that have a bigger profile, are going to get those large females' attention. They are hungry. They are looking for food. If you can find them, make sure that you're throwing bigger baits. A big bass will follow a big bait a very large distance. If you are going for other warm water fish, walleye, perch, crappie, make sure you're using smaller jigs and try and find where these fish are going to start staging to move into the spawning areas.
For Radio Catskill, this is Alex and Matt from Cooks Falls with your regional fishing report.
This is Stephanie Phillips for Farm and Country. Today's guest on Now You Know is Mark Gidley, an expert arborist who works out of Hankins, New York. Mark has 32 years of experience as an arborist. I asked him to explain how to choose a tree for your property.
Hi, I'm Mark Gidley, arborist. I've worked both on the West Coast and the East Coast. I studied at the New York Botanical Gardens in the Bronx back in the mid-80s. So I actually certified at the Botanical Gardens back in 1987.
Mark, I'd like to talk about the trees that people plant on their property. What are the most common types of trees that you plant?
What I've been finding more recently is a lot of people, they like dogwoods, the American dogwood in particular.
They're beautiful.
They are. The only problem with the American dogwood is it has a blight. And that's been prevalent for almost 50 years now. And the blight's called anthracnose, A-N-T-H-R-A-C-N-O-S-E. You can tell this by looking at the leaves, and you'll see a slight purplish discoloration, and then usually you get one or two small holes in the leaves, and quite often they'll die off completely. And then the branches will die back completely too. It can take some time to kill off a mature tree, but I unfortunately wouldn't advise planting an American dogwood, Cornus florida, botanically. There are now a lot of hybrids. Princeton University, there's a couple of professors down there that have hybridized 1% with the Korean dogwood, which is Cornus kusa. So you've got the American dogwood, which is Cornus florida, and then you have the Korean dogwood, which is Cornus kusa. So they 1% hybridized the kusa with the florida, and that makes it blight resistant. It doesn't flower at the same time. The American dogwood puts the flower out before it puts the leaves out. Whereas with the Korean dogwood, that will put the flower out in June time, but it has carpets of flowers, literally from the trunk all the way out to the tips. Just beautiful, beautiful white flowers. So that already has the leaves on it before it flowers, whereas it's the opposite with the American dogwood. Now there are, as I said, hybrids, which are 1% Korean dogwood and 99% American dogwood. And there are some, I think they're called summer stars, some are called Milky Way, constellation. Somebody must have liked the night sky. And again, most of those I'll buy locally. I'll just go right to Agway. 9 out of 10 times they have what I need. And that makes life so much simpler too, because being way out here, you don't have to drive an hour, hour and a half to buy your trees to come all the way back again. So to have something right in town is a blessing.
I wanted to ask some practical questions about trees for a person's property. Since we live in a very rocky, mountainous area with rather extremes of cold in the wintertime, what types of trees would you recommend for planting around somebody's property?
Okay, in terms of foundation plantings, I like to steer away from putting something in that looks really nice for a few years, but is going to grow to become a problem. As I say to people, if you're buying a puppy, be sure of what you're buying, because you might be buying a Great Dane puppy. The same thing with trees. If you're putting a tree in and it's only going to be 5 feet away from your foundation, then you're looking at something that potentially the roots could come in and become a problem for the foundation itself. The branches can become a problem for the side of the house, the roof, skylights, windows, what have you. And also storm damage. If you put in a white pine, which could grow 2+ feet, maybe 3 feet in a year, and is very brittle and subject to storm damage in the winter months, within a short space of time, you could be in a storm and suddenly have part of the tree come through your roof.
I think that those white pines can get to be like 100 feet tall. They're very big trees.
Yes, they can. They're actually the tallest trees and the fastest growing evergreens in the northeast. My understanding is north of here, up in Maine, they grow to 200 feet tall.
Whoa.
Which is incredible. I've not seen one 200 feet tall in Maine, and I have been up there, but I've certainly been up white pines in New York State that are about 120 feet quite often. So getting back to the trees around the property, I tend to go with something that's a little more ornate, ornamental, slow growing, maybe something that flowers on a cornus kusa, a Korean dogwood. I think that that would be an ideal tree to have close to a foundation and could be incorporated in a planting with several bushes, shrubs, etc. There's too many times that I've seen situations that put something in that looks terrific in the beginning, but then within a short space of time, maybe 5 to 8 years, let's say, that whatever tree has gone in there, and sometimes even the bushes, just become too cumbersome and a problem that then you're ending up either transplanting if you're able to, or having to cut them back from the side of the house.
What else besides the dogwood would you recommend?
The thing in this neck of the woods is the zone, and that reflects on the tree's ability to survive a particularly cold winter. And the zones are numbered, starting, I believe it's 1 would be close to Canada, and then you're going down to maybe 12 or 14 if you get to Mexico. Right here, we're at about a zone 4.5. Sometimes you can put in a zone 5 and get away with it. But if you get a particularly cold winter, then a zone 5 tree would die. And I think zone 5 is consistent with several winters becoming minus 20.
Yeah, that's kind of what happens with the peach trees. They're lovely to have, but then that comes that cold winter and that's the end of them.
Peach trees are ideal in more of a zone 6. So Westchester County, for example, would be perfect for them. But then peach trees get their own little problems with bugs, blights, and diseases beyond the zoning thing. They can be temperamental.
Right. What about magnolias? They're so gorgeous, and you do see them around here.
Yes, magnolias are. They're one of my favorites. There's 3 different types of magnolia that I'm aware of that will do okay here for the zone 4.5. And I've also seen magnolias bloom 3 times in a year, which to me is pretty amazing. Again, they're fast growing. It's relatively soft wood. You've got to be a little bit careful with those, but that's one tree that you can get away with putting it a little bit closer to a property and still being able to cut it back year by year, like a big bush in a way. But again, over time, it is a tree and its trunk's going to become sizable. So be careful exactly where you're planting those.
You haven't mentioned maples. I think the red maples in particular are just beautiful.
I love red maples. I love a lot of the native trees, and I'll steer that way if I can. There's several red maples out there which will do just fine up here. Now, the red maple is a sugar maple cousin. I think with a sugar maple, it's something like 24 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup. You could do the same thing with a red maple, but it would be something crazy like 50 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup. Yeah, red maples tend to do reasonably well. One thing that they can get is a fungus called tar spot. Usually does not kill them. It's just like a little black spot that you get on the leaf. So if you do see that, it's treatable with a copper-based fungicide, which a lot of people would use on their vegetables. So it's very safe. If you're using it on tomatoes, as long as you wash them the day before you eat them, that's fine. So treating your tree with a copper-based fungicide is perfectly fine.
Another tree that I like because it's so pretty are the birches. Can you say something about how they do up here?
Yeah, well, birches, of course, are a native tree to this area. I love birches. I love the paper bark birch with that exfoliating bark. The river birch, which is a fast, fast-growing tree and gorgeous. They're a little vulnerable to storm damage. The tops tend to break or bow down quite often with the ice storms. There are several things that the birches can get. Bronze birch borer, birch leaf miner, and then there's something else called cymeflux. They're all treatable. Whether it's a solution that you pour around the trunk, or micro-injectors, or capsules, or a spray. Unfortunately, I mention all these things, but if you put a tree in the ground and cross your fingers and hope it's going to grow, you might be lucky. But the odds are something's going to come along, bug, blight, or a disease that may cause a problem with it. And as long as your arborist's out there and he knows what he's talking about, then hopefully you can treat that tree and it'll go on to live a long, healthy life.
You haven't said much about the evergreens, and we're talking about foundation planting in particular, so which ones would you recommend?
Evergreens I like because you get that year-round screening. We did speak about the white pine, how tall they grow and how fast they grow. In terms of screening, at my property I have an arborvitae. Mine is called the Green Giant. Now, out of all the arborvitae, there's only one that the deer won't eat. And it's rare if they do. They might chomp on them a little bit and test them out when they first go in, but usually they'll back away from them. The Green Giant will grow at an incredible rate. It's amazing screening, and right now I'm working on making mine into like a natural hedge. It's good for reducing sound and visibility too. So where my property is several feet back from the road, it's still close enough that if large trucks and so on travel by, that now with this recent planting of these trees, I've noticed that it does reduce the sound. There's also emerald green arborvitae. There's something called the pyramidalis, and then there's a black arborvitae. All of those, the deer will eat to a nub or a lollipop. They'll eat them up to browsing height. And it's usually the winter months when all the underbrush dies back in the woods that the deer will come out at nighttime, and they're going to just devour whatever trees that take their fancy and they like, they'll eat. There are some things that are poisonous to the deer, boxwood being one, but of course it's not a tree, that they won't eat. I have a list that was given to me about 25 years ago, and it was called deer-resistant plants. And as the years go by, that list has become smaller and smaller.
Uh-huh. I have a kind of an accent tree. I think it's called a thuja. It's very tall and spectacular, but I will admit we had to prop it up because it kind of tore out during the winter.
Okay, so you have a thuja occidentalis, which is basically your arborvitae. That's the botanical name. And a lot of people call them thujas or thujas. The green giant that I have is a thuja. And that is your family name for those particular trees. Do you know what type yours is?
I don't know. It's just like a spike. It's skinny and very tall.
That sounds like the pyramidalis. And that's one the deer tend to eat. Unless you've got something to keep the deer away, they're probably going to come in and chomp on that.
They haven't so far, but we've got dogs. So that's some ideas for foundation plantings. What if you want a specimen tree? We've talked about magnolia and dogwood. What else would look nice just sitting singly in the middle of your yard?
I prefer flowering trees, personally. One of my favorites is a tree that's called a stuartia. Its botanical name is Stuartia pseudocamellia. It puts a flower out that is just like a camellia flower. Absolutely gorgeous. That tree I would call a specimen tree and plant by itself.
Well, thank you. That's a nice suggestion. You can contact Mark with your tree questions by email at treeusa@yahoo.com. So now you know what to think about when choosing a tree. Our tree expert has been Mark Gidley from Hankins, New York. If you have suggestions for future topics and experts, please email me at stephanie@wjffradio.org. This has been Stephanie Phillips for Farm and Country.
Here's an important note that I'd like to share with you, and with a bit of effort, we can help protect our environment. Now we are in the presence of spring, and we'll find ourselves outdoors, enjoying a walk, preparing garden beds, or raking up yard debris. Please take some time to learn about the spotted lanternfly, which has become a destructive pest to our Catskill Mountain, Delaware Valley region. The spotted lanternfly is a serious invasive pest with a healthy appetite for our plants. It can be a significant nuisance affecting our quality of life and enjoyment of the outdoors. The spotted lanternfly feeds on the sap from over 70 different plant species, including grapevines, maple trees, black walnut, birch, willow, and other trees, damaging their health and potentially killing them. There are several stages to the life cycle of this pest: the egg stage, nymph cycle, and adults with wings. They change color with each phase of their growth. Please learn how to identify this invasive pest and what action to take to help control the spread of the spotted lanternfly. I encourage you to visit the Penn State Extension website, extension.psu.edu/spottedlanternfly. Or you can call their hotline, 1-888-422-3359. Once again, for the most recent information on the spotted lanternfly, visit the Penn State Extension website, extension.psu.edu/spottedlanternfly. Call their hotline at 1-888-422-3359. If you'd like to hear archived Radio Catskill podcasts on this subject of the spotted lanternfly, visit wjffradio.org. Search the archives for local news, March 18th, 2021. And Farm and Country Saturday broadcast, April 27th, 2019, with Heather Leach. And Farm and Country Archives for February 15th, 2020, with Stephanie Phillips and Brenda Miller. We hope that you enjoyed our show this week, with production by WJFF Radio Catskill volunteers Keith Hubbard, Alex and Matthew Hoschka, and Stephanie Phillips. This has been your host, Rosie Starr. Thanks for listening to Farm and Country on WJFF Radio Catskill. Feel free to visit our webpage, wjffradio.org. You'll find podcasts for our local news and all kinds of resource information. And while you're visiting us online, click that donate button, wjffradio.org. We appreciate your support. Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.
If you hear good music, you're listening to Radio Catskill. Clyde Alvin Yates III sets it off Saturday night at 7. At 9, an hour of global sounds on Afropop. Then at 10, selector Starkey and DJ Chuck spend 4 hours